The Business on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Ulster Bank. For when you want business experts that get to know you, not just your business, visit ulsterbank.ie/businessmatters.
RTE Radio 1.
The Business on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Ulster Bank. For when our sector expertise can help your business succeed, visit ulsterbank.ie/businessmatters.
Good morning. Coming up, Catherine Thomas on stomach crunches and crunching numbers. Two comic takes on Brexit and finding a creative space away from it all. You can contact the show by text to 51551, by phone to 1850715150, or tweet to @thebusinessRTE. Well, our first guest this morning has made millions from creative businesses, but Jerry Kennelly has been immersed in creative work his entire life, beginning with his parents' photography business in County Kerry. He made headlines in 2006 when he sold his firm Stockbyte to Getty Images. But since then, he set up Tweak.com, a junior entrepreneurship program, and is a judge in the Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year. Jerry, we'll start with your father and mother's business. Was there a lot of money taking photographs in Kerry in the 1950s?
Well, I don't think there was a lot of money in anything in the 1950s, but I think, because of the fact that the first thing he needed to do was to make a living, he would shoot everything. He would shoot dances, he would wheel Santa around to every school in the county, he'd do news work, he got television cameras and shot for Pathé News, for ITN, for BBC. When RTE opened, he became a stringer for RTE, doing everything from Newsbeat to Nuacht to the news. So we were very used to being sort of lighting assistants and props in all of these things, and always work behind the scenes, myself and my three brothers.
In fact, I'm just looking here at a book that you published with some fantastic archive photographs, and it seems as if maybe yourself and some of your siblings were like props in all kinds of circumstances. There's one here of what looks like an unexploded bomb on a beach in Kerry, and yourself and your brother, a young fella, standing in beside it. Did he tell you to get in?
Absolutely. We knew what was going to make a picture, so the thing is, and every picture, every story would be shot for both stills and for TV. So we would walk at the scene and look at this bomb and hope to God it didn't blow up on us.
There's one of Charles de Gaulle that your mother, Joan, took.
Yes. So Charles de Gaulle visited Sneem in 1969 when Paris was literally burning, almost as it is now in a way. And he visited with his wife in a place called Heron Cove. It was owned by the Roach family. And my parents were on the story from the start. And on Sunday, de Gaulle and his wife went to the local church. And the photographers were told, you can come into the church, but you can't bring your equipment. So Joan went in, and because she was using these little rangefinder cameras, de Gaulle was standing, everyone else was sitting, as is the French tradition. And she took her camera out, took a couple of frames at an eighth of a second of de Gaulle standing in this church, and it was stupendous. She was immediately arrested.
Is that right?
And pulled away from the detective and got into her Mini, drove back to Tralee. And I remember the tension when the film was being put into the tank, and when she saw the result. I mean, she was so proud to start with such an incredible achievement. But she was banging on the phones and negotiating with picture editors all over the world for this fantastic picture, and I don't know how much was involved, but she did a significant deal with the picture editor of Paris Match, where she got a double page spread.
And tough negotiator, better than Theresa May, sounds like.
A tough negotiator. She wasn't. She knew the value of what she had on the day. So, she was the commercial operator. She made people feel very comfortable, and she just fitted into the scene. Whereas my father was more of a Ben Hur kind of an operator.
But together, running that business in Tralee at that time, supplying photographs, because you had this whole studio that was supplying wire photographs to newspapers and pictures all around the world if there was some big story happening.
Absolutely, and we were all part of it. The kids were part of it. So, I mean, there wasn't too much tension when it was a regular story like football matches or racing or the greyhound racing or whatever. But when it was a big story, there was absolute tension and the adrenaline was running. And of course there were no mobile phones at that time, and it was all primarily black and white. So my dad might process film in the car coming back from a big story. So you'd arrive in and the film would be washed, it would be put through Methodist spirits, dried with a hairdryer, and then there's tension as he looks at the frames to see, is it there? And within seconds it's in the enlarger. He's making a print, or my mum is making a print, and magically under the yellow sodium light this news picture is coming alive. And we would literally take over, myself and my brothers, into the acid bath, into fixer, into the wash, into the glazing machine, up to the wire room where we had this 84-year-old operator called Paddy McGrath. And Paddy had a bit of a shake in his hand. You had to help him put the print on the drum, and you'd type up a caption. We were all pretty good typists as kids, and you get the first print across on the transmitters, and that repeated and repeated until the story was exhausted. And I know to all the news outlets, when the story was over, there'd be Tri-X yellow cartridges on the floor of the dark room. It was almost like expended shells after a battle. And of course there'd be a session around the kitchen table where the chase and the kill would be recounted over a few mugs of tea or maybe a drop of Remy Martin.
If it was a big story and there was a good check coming.
Yeah, I was. And, to us, our parents were absolute champions. They were taking on the world, and they were bringing us into this magical world, connecting with people all over the world and being very active in doing that.
You wouldn't necessarily get a big story and an international story like that very often. There had to have been a cash cow part of the business. What was that?
Well, the cash cow was the Ken Card black and white postcard series. So my parents both drove Volkswagens in the 50s and 60s, and they would travel to every town and village in Ireland.
Beatles, sir.
Volkswagen Beatles, yeah. And so they would take pictures of the churches and the streets and the local monuments, and they would create real photo postcards in the basement of our home in Tralee. So we had maybe 10 or 15 people working there producing. I remember the Warwick Hotel in Galway was always a big favourite, and as young kids we'd be in there polishing the glazing machines, packing up these things, printing the on the back of the pictures the postcard credits and so on. So it was really you have to be adaptable, and they were, and the Santa was a big money spinner, of course, and that kept the show on the road. And the dance halls, I mean, they'd go to every dance in the county and have the pictures on the window in the shop the next morning. And those pictures became really important because people depended on clothes from America, for example, and those pictures would be sent back to America to recognise the fact that they wore the clothes at the ICA dance or whatever it was. And that was the whole social scene at the time.
One of the problems that you had was flooding. There was a lot of flooding in that part of Tralee at that time, and there were a number of occasions when the basement got flooded, damaging equipment.
That's right. Well, we decided to get out of the black and white postcard business and get into colour postcards. And my father got into hock to buy all this equipment, this printing equipment, and was kind of getting his head around trying to use it. It was a bit of a challenge. And and at the same time, the tourism business, which was primarily British tourism at the time, collapsed because of the what was going on in the north. And we got a bit of a knockout punch because this flooding started, and all of the equipment was destroyed several times, and we were almost put out of business. So one morning in 1974, my dad came down to breakfast with a couple of sheaves of SRA2 paper and said, "Lads, we're starting a newspaper. It's going to be called Kerry's Eye, and it's coming out in 2 weeks." So it was my mum and himself, and myself and my brother Padraig and young brother Kerry at the time, and we just made it happen. I don't know how it happened. We had two IBM typewriters, we had the printing equipment and the darkroom equipment, and it was going to be full colour. And the only full colour newspaper in Ireland at the time was the Sunday World, and it was going to be delivered free to every home in Tralee at the time.
He must have had incredible get up and go, as well as a sort of bravery to take on to do that. You guys were sort of swept along. You were fairly young. You probably didn't have much choice in the matter. Was there a bit of
child labour about it?
There was a lot of child labour, I can tell you. And but I mean, of course, the motivation was to solve the flooding problem. So it was he was really anxious that the council solved this problem.
So
they
the
weren't
newspaper
about
was going to campaign.
It was a
deliberate campaign to solve
a campaigning that. Newspaper. And as it happened at the time, the Kerryman was the most successful regional newspaper, and they've been given socks to each other ever since.
Now the newspaper obviously took off, and there was a lot of hard work involved. Did you hire in, outside of the family, many other people? Were there any other young apprentices?
There were indeed, and I suppose we had a sheet-fed newspaper press, a Salna 225, that you could print two colours at a time. So every sheet had to pass through eight times, and then it had to be collated and folded and delivered to various delivery points around the town. So we had a lot of young people, and they worked for a relatively small amount of money in this horrible environment. And my grandaunt, Auntie Alice, who was in her 80s, was in charge of supervising that operation, and there were a few disruptions now and again, but we got the paper out. It was a bit of a child slave operation, and I'm sure it wouldn't happen today. There was a strike one time caused by a young man called Pascal Sheehy, who now works for this organisation.
Yes.
And Pascal decided that he'd put the squeeze on the Kennedys for a little bit more money. The business was right beside a sweet wholesaler next door, so I think my father bribed the rest of the employees, including Pascal's brother, with some chocolate bars, and left Pascal outside for a few extra days just to teach him a bit of a lesson. But I'm sure it's part of the character that he built as he started on his journalistic career.
Yeah, it didn't do him any harm. Pascal's obviously gone a long way. Now, in terms of, it was almost inevitable with that background that you would take to photography and get involved in taking pictures. And again, among the photographs that are in the book, there's a fantastic picture of the former IRA man from Cork, Sean O'Callaghan, that you took. Mm. That was what, in the 1980s?
That's it, around 1981, yeah. So Callan had been on hunger strike in the year before, and I'd got some pictures of him, and as it happened, he became very hot property. He was the most wanted man in Europe. It was alleged that he was in the UK to kill Lady Diana, to kill Maggie Thatcher. He had a fearsome reputation. Those pictures were, I was selling, the only pictures in the world was selling those to the newspapers as they required them. But I remember one Saturday I got a call from the Mail on Sunday, and they said, look, we want you to work exclusively for us today with my old mate Jerry Collaran. So we worked through the day and really didn't get anything. A lot of those big stories where you expect to get something fantastic, it doesn't happen. There were maybe 50 or 60 Fleet Street journalists in Kerry chasing this down at the same time.
But you were trying to get tips or information as to where is this guy,
basically. You're pushing your sources and whatever else. So the thing is, I put word out to my sources that I had something that Callan might like to see. I had a picture that I was going to release, but I didn't want to release it without his permission. So there were no mobile phones, of course. So I said, look, tell Sean I'll be at home at 6 o'clock, and maybe if he might give me a call, I'll release the picture or not, depending on what he wants to do.
What was the picture?
I told them that I had a picture of him in full para, but I didn't.
Right. So he showed up then, and he agreed.
We had a few pints, and in the Ballymac bar, and he told me the story. He said he wasn't out to kill anyone. He was a great admirer of Maggie Thatcher, and got a nice yarn from him. And I was really thinking about the fact that there was so much doublespeak going on with MI5 and all this other stuff, that my credibility could have been really destroyed if I couldn't prove for certain that Callaghan was there on the day. So I said, look, Sean, do you mind tomorrow morning if I pick you up in my van at about 7 o'clock and we'll go down and we'll do a picture outside the town hall to prove that you're there on the day? So we did a picture of Callaghan in front of the Ash Memorial Hall in Tralee with that day's Mail on Sunday. And the headline in the Mail on Sunday was Jackal Targets Jenkins, with my picture on the front page.
Did you get for that picture, Jerry?
It made a lot of money. It made six figures over a number of years. But I suppose the thing is that, you know, the key thing is timing. I remember I was talking to my mother about this at the time, Joan, and she said, wait, you have it now, wait, don't be tipping everyone else off. So wait till the afternoon. So at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I sent the telexes out to all the news desks, and there was no chance that anyone would beat me. So I had it in the bag, and you know, I think 45 front pages the next day, you know, hundreds and thousands of publications since, every major news documentary that covered the story used that picture. But it was just, it wasn't a fantastic picture, but it was just knowing, it started creating something that was of value that proved a point on the day.
Now, of course, after Kerry's Eye, for you, you moved on to set up Stockbite, which became a hugely successful photographic agency, where you would have taken so many stock and file pictures from a base in Kerry, selling them all over the world. It's interesting, as you tell the story about your parents being involved locally but plugged in from the 1960s and 1970s into the wider media world. In a way, you found a way of replicating that with Stockbite.
Absolutely. I mean, I love Kerry. I love living in Kerry, and I don't think I'd want to compromise in that. Yet at the same time, I was interested, and I'm interested in having a professional career that matters, and being connected to technology and exciting things that are happening and that I'm interested in around the world. So that gave me the chance to create a global business from my own hometown.
But so many people in Ireland had no idea that they might have known Gerry Kennelly, they might have known Kerry's Eye, they might have known you had a photographic company called Stockbite. It was really only when it was sold and valued at, what, $140
million?
$135 million, that people went, I didn't know that was there.
Yeah, well, I suppose the thing is, you know, it, like everything else, it ultimately it was a bubble. We created a great business. Ultimately, we auctioned the company, and that was the value of it. It was based, I guess, on the valuation of stock photo companies. Getty were trading at 38 times earnings. That surprised me. I was a finalist in the EY Entrepreneur of the Year Awards, and Dennis O'Brien was a judge. I got an envelope in the post with a little note from Dennis saying, "You might be interested in reading this." And it was a broker report on Getty Images, and outlining the value of Getty Images and why they were worth 38 times earnings. And frankly, I knew that was a crock, and I knew the game was up. So it was just a matter of getting out intelligently for as much value as we could.
So you went for 38 times earnings on the sale price, plus a bit for future development and growth.
Exactly. So, you know, it was an interesting process to auction your company. I knew nothing about mergers and acquisitions, but we had three bids, and a little bit of a haggling, a little bit of negotiation, and we got it over the line.
Someone who achieved all of that and building that business and selling it for that sort of price, we all sort of think, well, if that was me now, I'm made for life, I'm going to put my feet up, I'm going to enjoy the money that I have earned. Is that you?
No, not really. I mean, I think money is just one currency, and you know, the other currencies matter just as much. Your relationships, your health. And ultimately, the real resource is time.
You must enjoy it on some level, Gerry. I seem to remember you saying shortly afterwards, you'd only ever drink champagne for the rest of your life. Is that true? Are you still on champagne only, or are you back on the pints?
I'm back in the pints and the champagne occasionally. It's no, a drop of champagne is no harm for you to get the day going. But it's the reality is, you know, normality is wonderful. And it's great to be able to do good work and work with really clever colleagues, and that's a big part of my life. And you know, I'm yes, of course, you have the benefits of having some resources, but I mean, I've had no resources, and I've had the arse hanging out of my trousers plenty of times in my life, and I was just as happy.
You set up Tweak in Killorglin as a new venture shortly after you'd sold Stockbite. How's that going? What does the company do?
So I suppose there's three parts to Tweak. There's we started Tweak as a means of effectively almost replicating what we did with Stockbite with design. So I reckon that it was we were only doing a small part of the whole picture with stock photography. A lot of small businesses around the world need access to great design, need access to great branding, because quite often they're competing against big brands and multinational companies. So the idea was to democratize design, create a huge bank of design, make it easy to edit online, And that's what we did. We set about it. It was a much bigger task than I could ever have imagined. Very difficult technology. But today we have 1.5 million pieces of design in 7 languages across 350 different business types. And that's used by print partners around the world, people like Flyer Alarm in 12 countries across Europe, and Hello Print and so on. So when somebody in Spain or in Germany or in Mexico is creating a piece of design, it's being created in Killorglin. The technology that supports it is made there, and it allows those companies to actually utilise the customers, the visitors to their website, and lower the cost of conversion.
You're a great believer in building these businesses in places like Killorglin, which are small towns in rural hinterlands, a long way from the capital city, or even, you know, away from Cork or Limerick or wherever it is. Do you think that we could do more in terms of education, in terms of driving enterprise, those kinds of things, to bring indigenous jobs like that to those towns?
I think there's lots of education, but not a lot of skills. I mean, for example, if you take a really hot area like, for example, software engineering, it's a great career. It's really well paid. And, you know, there's lots of jobs outside of Ireland. Between the banks and the government, I believe that there's 50,000 jobs out that are being outsourced for something that should be a core skill for a digital economy.
It's because we don't have enough software engineers, ours are too expensive.
There are 1,300 a year who graduate. I mean, there are room for tens of thousands, but we don't produce the people. And
why not? Is it that when you mention software, people think it's all about maths, and I'm not good enough at maths, or I'm not interested enough, and that may be a misconception they have? Or is it that parents, for example, are encouraging their kids to go in and take up a profession and go into one of the service professions?
There is a bit of that in terms of parents choosing to do what they would have done in their generation. But times have changed radically. In accounting and law and lots of other areas, automation is going to wipe out a whole lot of jobs. But I think that third level education is a nice to have. It's the cherry on top. The first thing that you've got to have as when you become an adult going out into the world to work is to have a skill that you can make a living with. And we're doing that really badly.
What about all of these supposedly high-skilled jobs that are here from tech multinationals, for example?
Most of the tech multinationals don't do any research and development in Ireland. That means we don't get the valuable jobs. We get the sales and marketing jobs, mostly people coming in from outside, filling those jobs. And there's a huge benefit to the Irish taxpayer, of course, and it's a great success for the IDA. But strategically for our country, we don't produce the kind of people that could do the R&D for Google or for Amazon or for Facebook. So we don't get those jobs. We don't get to play in the high-value game. And you don't need to go to college for 4 years to become a software engineer.
You didn't go to college yourself, did you?
Never went. I didn't do the leaving cert, that I might go to college.
You left school before the leaving.
I did indeed. I became an apprentice and I had a very tough apprenticeship with my father as a photojournalist. So I graduated from the school of life.
Do you believe then in apprenticeships, in having things that have a purely skill outcome, a skill focus, and it doesn't necessarily involve university at all? Is that the way
absolutely.
You should be thinking?
Absolutely. I think that's a great place to start. That should be the default. What I see with a lot of university graduates is that it's 8 or 10 or 12 hours a week. That's not the way it is in a lot of other countries. So I think the reality is for a lot of people who come out of third level education is their first job, the employer has to teach them how to work.
You're still living in Kerry. You've always lived in Kerry?
Always lived in Kerry.
No plans to change that?
No plans at all. As my father used to say, a day out of Kerry is a day wasted.
Well, Gerry Kennelly, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Super.